Hello, this is Dan.
Love Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Dan Smetanka from Counterpoint Press, and I'm very pleased to have the opportunity to speak today with one of our authors, Susan Sherman, whose first novel, The Little Russian, will be publishing in January of 2012. Hello, Susan.
Hello, Dan. Thank you for having me.
How are you?
Very happy to be here. I'm fine. I'm just fine. I'm excited about the launch of the novel and getting ready for it and busy, but it's just great.
Good. Well, you have a very interesting background, both in academia and then as the co-creator of a television show for Disney called That's So Raven. What is it like now to have written and be publishing your first novel?
Well, I guess I just kind of like to do a little here and a little there, and this is something brand new for me, publishing. And I'm just having a great time. It's really fun. I'm meeting really wonderful, interesting people. And I love writing, of course. Writing is my first love. And this novel was a long time in the making. It was 8 years, but it was a labor of love. And finally, it's coming to fruition. So I'm very excited about it.
Good. The Little Russian is already getting some wonderful pre-pub reviews. I want to focus specifically on Library Journal, who in their starred review spoke about your main character in The Little Russian, Berta, and they called her a fascinating mix of petty vanity, devoted parenting, and breathtaking courage. And I couldn't agree more. Berta is a really interesting main character and quite a complicated one. So let's talk about her and how you came to create her.
Well, Berta Olshansky is actually based on the real Berta Olshansky, my grandmother. She changed her name when she came to this country to Bessie Sherman. But I used her as my model, and through my father, who told stories about her through my whole life, I got a pretty good idea who she was. I knew her when I was little. And she is a very interesting, you know, very wonderful character. And so I used her as a model for the character in the book. And I think I captured her pretty closely.
How much of the novel is based on her and her experience?
Yeah, her experiences. Well, you know, the novel is fiction, but it's based a lot on her life. I used the stories of my grandmother have been traveling through my family since forever. And everyone sort of has a different vision of what went on in her life. But I kind of, you know, took from here and took from there and made a narrative, made a novel out of it, but it's based a lot on her actual story. So these are really, a lot of these events really happened, maybe not in exactly the same way, but they really happened. So, it's a really interesting journey to take someone's life and turn it into a novel.
And what was that like, Susan? What is your process for turning something from your family into a kind of traditional historical novel?
Well, I didn't have a lot to go on in terms of archival evidence of my grandmother's life. I had some immigration papers, a few photographs, but when she left Little Russia, as it was called then, now it's called Ukraine, she traveled light. So, but I did a lot of research into the time period and into the places. I spent a number of years at UCLA in the research library, poring over maps and reading a lot of books. And I would find an interesting book in the library, and then I'd rush home and buy it on Amazon so I could, you know, write in it and dog ear it and stuff. So, it took a lot of research, many, many years of research to understand that period, to understand the culture and the people and all the major influences of that time. And then I just started writing after that. And then it was just a process of writing, maybe doing some more research, And finally I came up with a book.
Well, the novel ostensibly is Berta's story mm-hmm. as a kind of young girl and woman in Little Russia, now known as mm-hmm. the Ukraine, and we follow her through the outbreak of World War I, the terrible civil wars that plagued the area following the end of that war, and her experiences all along the way. And each, the four sections of the book are divided mm-hmm. up into kind of each identity that Berta assumes on her journey.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk a little bit about that structure and how that came to be.
Well, my grandmother had to assume certain roles in the society in order to survive. And she, you know, in the beginning, she, as a little girl, she was sent to live in a very wealthy household in Moscow as a companion to their daughter. Well, there are several different stories circulating in my family. You have to understand that there are, everyone has their own version of my grandmother's stories, but one of the versions is that she had gone to this wealthy house. And then as a result, she lived there. She was educated as a lady, as a Russian lady. She spoke Russian. She spoke French. She was, a cut above, or I guess, she enjoyed the gifts and the education of a wealthy family. And then at some point she was sent back to live in the little shtetl where she was born. And she was an outcast. And she was an outcast not just because, you know, of the fact that she had been gone for so long, but that because she had a certain feeling about herself. She felt herself better than everyone in the shtetl, and they resented her for that. And so it was very difficult for her to come back to this dusty little shtetl on the west bank of the Dnieper River in her satins and silks, speaking French. And so the first part of the book is based on her experiences in Moscow. We call it The Lady from Moscow, and her experiences coming back to the shtetl. Now I can't remember what you're...
In that first section, The Lady from Moscow, Berta is getting ready for a trip.
Mm-hmm.
Later, on that same train, Berta meets a stranger whom she seeks to impress with descriptions of her life in Moscow.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you read us a little bit of that passage, as it gives us a pretty good idea of what you're talking about here and what her life was like in the kind of fabulous and wealthy homes of Moscow.
Okay, we'll be glad to do that. So here she is on this train, and... She's meeting a stranger who is very impressed by the fact that she's coming from this very wealthy sugar family. And she omits certain facts because she wants to present herself as, as part of this world, even though she's kind of a peripheral part of this world. So I'm going to read you this passage. Okay. She told her about their horses in Petrovka Park, their box at the Bolshoi, and their salon on Tuesdays. She described her former classmates at the girls' gymnasium, Arizonev, their prominent families, and the sensational gossip that no unmarried girl of 23 should know, much less repeat. It wasn't that Berta was unduly influenced by the awe, excitement, and envy so plainly displayed on Alexandra Dmitrievna's face. She was simply relating her life as she had been asked to do. True, she admitted a few facts pertaining to her position in the world as a distant cousin of the Makhils, and to be fair, she might have exaggerated her relationship with the more prominent members of society. But weren't these little transgressions forgivable, especially in light of the fact that she was giving Alexandra Dmitrievna Tretyakova something to talk about for the rest of her life? And all the women were wearing décolleté that evening to show off their diamonds. Berta had moved on to the coronation ball at the Hunters Club in May of 1896. Ludmila Borisovna wore a branch of them in her hair, and Grafina Sergeyevna had a rope of them tied around her waist. And you should have seen the roses, 100,000 of them. And then at midnight they brought in a huge replica of the Kremlin Cathedral made out of red sugar. It was gigantic and took 6 men to carry it in. It had real doors that opened, and everyone who went to the coronation said it was true, down to the last detail. Although Berta included plenty of colorful details in her description of that famous evening, she did leave out certain inconvenient facts. For example, there was that tragedy on Kodinka Field that happened in the early morning hours of the 18th, when 2,000 people were trampled to death by a panicked crowd of 600,000 who mistakenly believed the free beer was running out. When she described watching the fireworks from the club's terrace, she also failed to mention the line of carts rumbling by in the street below, and how, in the spectacular flashes of color from overhead, it was easy to see the blue-black bodies, the blood-stained tatters, the smashed noses, the eyes askew, and the many pairs of bare feet bouncing over the cobblestones. She also admitted the fact that the Malkiels were Jews and only invited to the ball because they owned the majority of sugar refineries in Russia and contributed more than 300 Russian pounds of red dyed sugar.
Thank you. At one point, Berta admits to the reader that she was born in Little Russia.
Mm-hmm.
But she really wants people to see her as a great Russian,
right?
As part of this very wealthy family. What does that say about her? Why is that so important? Is this a class perspective? Is it something about her Jewish background?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of everything, because Little Russia, Ukraine at that time, was under the auspices of Russia. They were, you know, they were in control of it. And they thought of it as a provincial backwater. And they didn't allow the Ukrainian language to be spoken. They didn't allow Ukrainian newspapers to be published or plays to be put on. And so they were looked down upon. And to be a great Russian, to be a real Russian and live in, you know, within the real the borders of the traditional Russian country, was considered, you know, you were above like all the other provinces. And it was very important to Berta, the real Berta and the Berta in the book, to present herself as something that she wasn't really, you know, she wanted to present herself as a grand lady who lived in a grand house and who was above the majority of Russians in her country. And this wasn't quite true. So she didn't really quite admit to even to herself that she was actually born in Little Russia and that she was really a Little Russian. And she kind of bought her own propaganda, so to speak. And so it was very important to present herself as something that she really wasn't. She wasn't quite, you know, it was a very, you know, important thing to present herself as the grand lady, which she wanted to be, not that she really was.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about Jewish life during
mm-hmm.
that time, which is a huge, important theme in the book, the kind of look at what life and eventually the persecution of the Jewish people at that time. I think most readers have all seen Fiddler on the Roof, which might be their kind of first or most kind of easily accessed memory of a shtetl. And in the movie, it doesn't seem that bad. Maybe
mm-hmm.
a little run down. But in your novel, Little Russian, the reality of shtetl life seems quite different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the shtetl life at that time, or at any time really, was a very harsh life. The Jews were, when Alexander II, he was a reformer, he was a friend of the Russian people, and he was assassinated. And there was actually a young Jewish girl who was part of the assassins who killed the Tsar. And when his son took power, Alexander III, in retribution, he blamed, you know, he scapegoated the Jews, as many, many people of that time did. And so he instituted what's called the May Laws, and they were passed during May. And the May Laws subjected the Jews to many restrictive laws that kept them pauperized, living in poverty in the shtetl. And they couldn't, for example, own mortgages. They couldn't, they couldn't go into certain professions. There were quotas on being doctors and lawyers, and they couldn't own land. And so they were kept out of a lot of careers and a lot of jobs. And And as a result, they lived very poorly in these shtetls. And so my portrayal of the shtetls is pretty accurate. It's pretty true to what it was. And then, of course, Hollywood romanticized the Tevye stories. And Sholem Aleichem, who's the author of the Tevye stories, romanticized it a little bit too. So anyway, so I think the portrayal in the book is closer to the truth of what it was like to live in the shtetl.
Mm-hmm. Well, this idea of the laws against the Jews, specifically the law that said that Jews were not allowed to own guns, figures mm-hmm. prominently mm-hmm. in the story of the Little Russian, most specifically when Berta finally meets a handsome wheat merchant who walks into her grocery by the name of Herschel.
Mm-hmm.
And they go on to kind of meet and fall in love, and I think it is really their epic love story that have led so many readers to think of Dr. Zhivago or Gone with the Wind. But as we look back, you know, to our discussion on the structure of the novel, once, you know, kind of Berta leaves Moscow, when she's back in her townlet of Mozny, it is Herschel who kind of finds her and takes her away from that.
Mm-hmm.
And in the third section of the book, titled The Wheat Merchant's Wife, Berta almost kind of assumes some of the glory of her young life, of that kind of rich and wealthy settlement that she'd had in Moscow. How accurate is it, Susan, that someone would be able to leave a townlet like Mozny?
Yeah. Yeah, there were Jews that were allowed to live beyond the Pale of Settlement, which was a designated area where they were forced to live, and, you know, since Catherine the Great. But there were Jews that were able to escape that through luck or connections. Very few were allowed to, but there were Jews that they had to get special dispensation from the Tsar in order to live outside of the Pale. And the Pale was an area in Russia that took in most of Poland and Ukraine, Belarus, parts of Romania. So it was kind of a large region. But these Jews that were allowed to leave, many of them went to Petersburg and became industrialists, and some of them went to Moscow. But it happened, and a few Jews were, you know, were allowed to be educated. They were allowed to own property and send their children to university or even to Paris or France for education. So it did happen. It was possible.
Okay. And a few Jews eventually were allowed to start smuggling guns, as we'll see in the novel. Herschel is, unbeknownst to most everyone in the novel, a gun smuggler. Mm-hmm. And secretly sending guns to the shtetls across the countryside so they can defend themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that becomes a major part of the second half of the novel.
Mm-hmm. Yes. This is a... oh, go ahead, I'm sorry.
So let's talk about that and how his actions figure into Berta's transformation.
Right. Well, what happened was, and this is true. That, I mean, because the Jews were not allowed to own guns, and because the Russian government did not protect them, and in fact, Nicholas II, the Tsar at the time, supported the All Russian Alliance, which was a group of reactionary forces that actually waged pogroms against the Jews. The Tsar used the pogroms against the Jews to take the mind off the people, off their plight, off the poverty and misery that the people were living in at this time. And so the Jews had no one to turn to. They couldn't defend themselves. They couldn't turn to the Russian government. There was actually an unwritten law in Russia at the time which said that a pogrom could go on for 3 days and three nights without any interference. And the Tsar looked at this as just a way for people to blow off steam. And so these pogroms would, you know, thousands of Jews died, their homes were destroyed, their women were raped, their children were killed. So it was a devastating time for the Jews, which only got worse during the Civil War, the Russian Civil War. So as a result, there was an organization called the Bund, and in my book, Herschel has joined this organization, and they had a self-defense wing where they would smuggle guns over the border and bring them to the shtetl and educate the men in the shtetl how to use them and how to defend themselves. And as a result, there were many pogroms that were stopped by these actions. And in the book, Herschel is involved in this, and he eventually gets one of his operations goes awry, and he has to leave America and for America, and Bertha does not want to go with him. This actually happened in real life.
Susan, let's talk about that choice, because it seems so key to who Bertha is as a character, this kind of very tense moment when Herschel knows that one of his smuggling operations has gone awry. He's in peril and jeopardy, and wants to leave immediately in the middle of the night with his family. Bertha does not want to go. She doesn't want to leave her house and her children, and it is quite a choice that she makes. And I think, you know, her kind of her hubris or her kind of tragic flaw is revealed. So we'll talk about that choice.
Well, you know, Bertha is very concerned about how people perceive her. That's one of her major flaws. And, you know, as a result, she does not want to go to America and be thought of as a greenhorn. She has seen pictures and magazines of how people live in New York in the Lower East Side, and she does not want to live like that. She's coming from a grand home, and she's established herself as a hostess. She has salons. She hosts grand parties, and she's not willing to give any of that up. So when her husband comes home one night in the middle of the night and tells her pack up and leave, we have to leave in 20 minutes, she balks. She's filled with pride, and she's also very independent in a sense that she won't do what other people tell her to do. She only wants to do what she wants to do, and what she wants to do is maintain her life, her status, the image that she's created for herself, and she's not willing to give that up. So it wasn't an unusual thing for women to stay behind and for men to go on to America and establish a life. That was a very common thing. So the fact that she wanted to stay behind, Herschel is devastated by her actions and leaving him in that, you know, in the lurch, so to speak, abandoning him in a sense. And he, you know, at first he doesn't want to go. He won't leave her, but she talks him into it. Situation is so tense that unless he goes, he's going to be arrested. So she decides to stay behind, and it's a fatal decision on her part.
As soon as she makes that choice, it feels like her die has been cast. And that one choice that she makes, not to leave with him and to stay behind, kind of really influences her life through the second half of the novel. Because as soon as Herschel leaves, World War I breaks out. The Russian losses in the first few months of the war were staggering, and the whole country is immediately thrown into disarray, and Bertha must fight to feed her family, to keep them warm through a terrible winter, and she becomes, in a sense, quite a different woman.
Yes. She goes through her transformation. What happens is she waits too long to leave. She sees World War I has broken out. Still, she's not willing to leave her life. Then the blockade of the Dardanelles in October. Of course, the war starts in August, the guns of August. And by October, she's trapped in Russia, in Ukraine, and she can't leave. And slowly, everything melts away. Her house, her money, her status, her position, everything slowly melts away, and she's left with nothing. She's left with her two children who are depending on her for everything. And she realizes one day when she's walking in the snow that if her children are going to survive, it will be up to her. If they go, if they're educated, it will be up to her. It's all up to her. There's no one else. And from then on, she becomes a very different person. She inch by inch, she steels herself against the situation, and she rises to the situation. She becomes a more noble person because of the adversity that she's going through, and she's transformed.
It well, feels like to me she's one of the first modern women. That all of the kind of ideas of a woman being taken care of and being pampered and caring about, you know, the house and the children and their station in life, she loses most of that very quickly and has to become an independent provider for her family, not for the purposes of their position or for their station, but for sheer survival.
Yeah, exactly. She is sort of the model of what women were going through at that time, because World War I wipes out a whole generation of men. And there is a whole generation of women who are having to make it on their own, who cannot, there no longer is the traditional role of wife and mother running the household available to them. So they have to get out there and they have to make their own lives. And as a result, many of the women become, you know, excel and become entrepreneurs. They have their own businesses. Women's suffrage has become the cause célèbre again, and women are fighting for the vote. It's sort of a resurgence of the whole women's movement in that sense, and women take on a whole new role as a result of World War I.
But before that, Berta must survive. She must survive the winter. She must survive World War I. She must survive the terrible civil wars that broke out even after the war was over, which saw great violence across almost all parts of the country and the countryside. So let's talk a little about her survival tactics. What did she do to feed her children to survive, really?
Yeah. Well, the World War I did not affect her all that much because she was on the west bank of the Dnieper River and the fighting was much farther to the west. So she wasn't too affected. There were terrible rationing and there was shortage of food, but it wasn't as bad as the Russian Civil War. The Russian Civil War, a huge part of it was fought right where she was. So there were all these forces, conflicting forces, converging on the people in Ukraine, especially on the Jews, and they became a target of roving bands, of bandits, of hetmen, of the whites and the reds. And anyway, so she had to somehow survive what was going on, all the violence and the starvation. And she did it by peddling. She became what's called a house Jew at the time, which is a derogatory term the Gentiles used to describe certain peddlers, but they were specialized peddlers. They could get you something that would be hard to find unless you knew all the ins and outs of the black market. And they often were turned to for advice. And so she became at first a house Jew during World War I and going from wealthy household to wealthy household, bringing specialty goods. And then as the fortunes turned and the war was, the revolution, 1917, and then the Russian Civil War, and people were losing everything. They lost their businesses. Everything was taken over by the government. There was no longer a need for house Jews. And then she just became a peddler, and she would go out to the countryside, even though it was extremely dangerous to go out to the countryside, because under war communism, you weren't allowed to sell. There was no market. Okay, there was a black market, but that was illegal. And if you were caught buying and selling, you were shot just summarily or hung. So it was very dangerous, even for a peddler, for a lowly peddler, to peddle, to buy things, to come back into the city and sell things. And my grandmother, the real Bear Dalshansky, and the character had to go out to the countryside, ride the trains, go out to the farmsteads, buy up things that could be used in the city. And there were, you know, trade, there was no currency, it was meaningless. The communists destroyed the currency. So there were always things to trade, buy, and sell. One of the biggest currencies at that time was vodka. So she was always on the lookout for bottles of vodka because she could trade them for food. And that's how she survived. And it was a very tenuous, very frightening livelihood and experience for her.
Mm-hmm. So as she faces these dire situations and fights for her survival, we see her kind of evolution from the lady from Moscow to the wheat merchant's wife to the house Jew. That eventually falls away, and Berta realizes it's time to get out.
Mm-hmm.
Much perhaps like your grandmother did.
Mm-hmm.
What were her options? In a country, you know, filled with civil war, filled with violence, mm-hmm. against the general populace, specifically against the Jews.
Right.
What choices did she have?
Well, she didn't have many because the borders were closed. They were shooting people who were trying to cross the borders. And even if you made it in through Romania to Poland, if you were a Russian in Poland, the Poles hated the Russians because Poland had been controlled by Russia for many, many years. And so if you were caught in Poland speaking Russian, you were arrested or executed. So it was a very, very difficult time to escape. Of course, this is like 1921, 22, and immigration was just beginning to be cut off in the United States. So it was a very difficult time. But the one thing that she had on her side was a network of peddlers who would bring news, real news, from the West. And so many of these Jewish families had families in the West, in the United States. And these peddlers would be, they would pick up the news, so-and-so was looking for so-and-so, and they would spread from peddler to peddler to peddler. And whoever found the person, the missing person who was being sought after by their relatives in the United States, were given a reward. So this is how news was traveled. News traveled through the shtetls and through the countryside. And one day my grandmother, Anne Berta Olshansky, learns that her husband is searching for her through one of these peddlers. And as a result, she wants to take the chance. She wants to somehow get across the border. And so she gathers up everything she has, sells it, raises a little bit of money, and sets off to cross the border.
Which, as you said, was a very dangerous thing for her to do.
Yes, yes. So it was just sort of, you know, having a general plan but not really knowing how she was going to do it until she reaches the border. And, you know, and then, of course, a lot of, you know, events, dangers, you know, adversity to overcome before she reaches the border.
Well, you write about these very kind of violent and epic struggles for the Jewish people mm-hmm. of that time, for the general population living through World War I and, of course, the terrible civil wars that happened after, the devastating winters,
mm-hmm.
which, of course, are all across the book, the anarchists, the bandits, who had no trouble killing Jews across the countryside. What draws you to this type of story that is filled with so much adversity mm-hmm. and struggle?
I guess I'm just sort of taken with the transformational effects of calamity on the individual and the different ways that people deal with calamity and what they take away from it. And it's just this heroic struggle that my grandmother went through and the transformation that happened to her and what she became at the end of it. It just drew me to this kind of story. And I don't know. It's something that, you know, I'm always drawn to the stories of struggling women who overcome great obstacles and become some, you know, a shining paragon. And that's what the kind of novel I wanted to write.
Great. Well, thank you, Susan, very much for
your
time today.
Thank you so much.
Good luck with the publication of your
Thank
novel,
you.
The Little Russian by Susan mm-hmm. Sherman, publishing on January 10th, 2012.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Left you on the debris. Now we both know you're